Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
Do you love true crime podcasts and true crime documentaries?
If so, you gotta check out our podcast, True Crime Obsessed, where we recap the true crime documentaries everybody's watching.
We say everything you're thinking and probably screaming at your TV.
We've been at the top of the podcast charts for almost 9 years, and we have over 400 episodes for you to check out right now.
We cover the cases everyone's talking about, and we also highlight the cases that have been underreported, overlooked, or forgotten.
With over 30,000 five-star reviews on Apple Podcasts, if you've never checked out True Crime Obsessed, now's the time to give us a try.
Find True Crime Obsessed wherever you get your podcasts.
Everyone, I'm Sam.
And I'm Sean.
And this is Key to the Case. Welcome back. Thank you all for tuning in once again. And like I said last week, Sean was gone for a while, but obviously he's back now.
Yeah, it was kind of an unexpected absence. I was only supposed to be gone for about 4 days up in Edmonton, Alberta, but it ended up being about 2.5 weeks. So that kind of threw a massive wrench in our recording plans, but thanks to Kristen, who did a great job.
Yeah, it was really nice to record with Kristen. I could have recorded by myself. I thought about it, but I really didn't want to. It kind of goes against the whole format and point of our podcast. And I really just didn't want to have to listen back to myself talking for an hour straight. So yeah, it was good to record with Kristen, but we're definitely glad to have you back. When deciding which case to cover this week, I kept coming across cases I wanted to feature, but they felt like they had too little information available. So I thought we could still cover these cases, but cover 2 or even 3 at a time. Today, we'll be discussing 2 different disappearances that are completely unrelated, but they have one detail kind of in common. If you all like this format, we can do this periodically in the future. I think I'll always prefer focusing on one case at a time, but this is a good way for us to feature some of these lesser known cases without much information while still putting an episode out that's a good length. All right, let's get into today's first case. Stephen Milan was 20 years old at the time of his disappearance in 1998. Stephen grew up in Canada and he studied business at Humber College in Toronto, Ontario. At the time of his disappearance, I believe he may have lived with his family in Mississauga, which borders Toronto, because that's where he was last seen. However, he could have lived on his own and have just been visiting his parents. Reportedly, around midnight on February 14th, 1998, Stephen left his family's home to travel to the United States to purchase a drug that was recently approved in the U.S. to treat baldness. Some have pointed out that in the few photos of Stephen that are available, it doesn't appear he was losing hair. His hair looks pretty thick. Although those photos could have been a couple years old, that's the only thing that makes sense because it's hard to imagine this detail being made up out of nowhere.
He could have started experiencing baldness in like the top back half of his head, like where you start forming like a cul-de-sac.
Yeah, and that wouldn't be seen in pictures right. necessarily, or at least the few pictures we have of Stephen. But even if those photos were taken when he was 18, he was 20 when he went missing. So he wouldn't look that different. So for all we know, they could have been kind of old pictures. But the timing is a bit strange. Around midnight, I'd been thinking he'd have to see a doctor to get a prescription for this medication and then get the prescription filled. But I learned that the hair loss medication, Rogaine, and its topical version have been approved for sale without a prescription in 1996 in the US. And then in early 1998, before Steven disappeared, a stronger formula was approved by the FDA for over-the-counter sales in the US.
But these weren't approved in Canada, which is the reason why he was traveling to the US, right?
That's the idea here. Yes, Canada followed suit not long after, but evidently it wasn't yet available over the counter in Canada. So because Steven wouldn't have needed a prescription, the timing is less of a question here. There was another medication approved for male pattern hair loss in 1997, but that medication was not available without a prescription. So I suspect he would have been looking for one he could get over the counter at a drugstore. Steven's vehicle, a 1991 Chevrolet Beretta, was tracked entering the United States at the Rainbow Bridge on February 14th. And the Rainbow Bridge is a gateway between Niagara Falls, Ontario and Niagara Falls, New York. And it would have taken Steven a little over an hour to drive from Mississauga to the Rainbow Bridge. He was never seen again, but there is no way to determine if Steven drove his vehicle into New York. All we know is that his vehicle crossed the border. When Steven didn't return, his family reported him missing because his absence was out of character. Although the date he was reported missing is unclear, and Steven's disappearance was not big news from what I could find. I don't even know his parents' names. There were no statements from family members. As you might expect in a case like this, there's virtually nothing. A few days later, a man in Arizona found Steven's vehicle abandoned and unlocked with the keys inside. Steven's car was parked by jewelry stands at the Little Colorado River Gorge Overlook near the Grand Canyon National Park. This location is more than 2,000 miles or more than 3,200 kilometers from Niagara Falls, where his vehicle was last tracked. It would be about a 32-hour drive if you were to drive straight through, which is highly unlikely, but we know it was found just a few days after Steven's car entered the U.S. So if Steven drove, we know he didn't make a lot of stops along the way, meaning he didn't stretch the drive out to explore other parts of the U.S. Despite his vehicle being in that location since February, law enforcement didn't know about it until June because the man who found it took it upon himself to drive it around for several months until it broke down. And some reports say it was stripped by the time law enforcement got to it, but I'm not 100% sure on that detail. A sheriff's officer investigated the vehicle that no longer had a license plate. They learned that the Chevy Beretta belonged to a missing man, Steven, after they ran the VIN. There was an extensive search in the area on foot and by air for Steven, but nothing was found. Investigators looked into the possibility that Steven's disappearance could be connected to that of another Canadian man who went missing around the same time as Steven at the Grand Canyon. Investigators theorized that the two men knew each other because they both had complicated family situations. Maybe they took off together. But that man's remains were found several years later, and his death is not believed to be connected to Steven's. That is all I could find on Steven's family. This one mention that his home life or his family life was complicated. It can be concerning when someone disappears and their relationship with their family is characterized as complicated, but we don't know the details of this complexity. So it's hard to make any sort of link to Steven's disappearance.
So it sounds like they're not extremely active publicly trying to find Steven.
No, I couldn't find much from them at all. I mean, I know they reported Steven missing, but yeah, they didn't seem to be out there making this big news. In 2012, law enforcement requested and received DNA from Steven's family to compare to unidentified remains found in Coconino County, which is where Stephen's car was found, as well as the rest of the state of Arizona. It's very plausible that if Stephen were found deceased in Arizona or anywhere in the U.S. and he didn't have identification on his person, he would remain unidentified. Through the comparisons of Stephen's family's DNA to that of unidentified remains, a match was never and has never been made. There are a few theories in this case, but the main categories are suicide and foul play. Could Stephen have driven all the way to Arizona to die by suicide at the Little Colorado River Gorge Overlook? Popular landmarks, especially in remote areas, can attract incidents like this, but I found no documented pattern of suicides at this specific location. It's notable, though, that through searches, Stephen was not found, but he could be in the gorge and he was missed in the searches. It would be quite a distance for someone to drive to die by suicide, but it wouldn't be unheard of. We know virtually nothing about Stephen's mental state at the time of his disappearance, so that doesn't help either. But I would like to know if Stephen ever expressed interest in visiting this part of the U.S. Maybe if he had a certain fascination with this spot, then that could lend some insight into this case. The other possibility is that Stephen met with foul play. We don't have proof that Stephen drove his vehicle to Arizona, so there is still a possibility that something happened to him in Ontario and someone else drove his vehicle to its final destination. I tend to have a hard time believing that someone would commit a crime and then drive the victim's car so far away. We talked about this in the Marshall Iwasa case. It would be a very risky thing for someone to do, and you'd have to spend a lot of money on gas for a trip of that distance. It's possible that Stephen drove all the way to Arizona for some reason and something happened to him from there, or he could have gotten to New York and was harmed and someone else drove his vehicle, or it could even be that something happened anywhere between Ontario and Arizona.
I think there's a third theory here, though. Could he have just wanted to start a new life in the U.S.?
Well, in that theory, do you think he was successful initially and then something happened to him? Or do you think he could possibly still be out there?
Yeah, I mean, you mentioned that his relationship with his family was complicated. So if he did start a new life, he could very well not have contacted his family and told them where he was.
Yeah, I think it's possible. I just think we always run into the same issue when we talk about this theory, is the practicality of it all, because there were no charges on any cards Stephen had after the fact. And I'm not aware of, I mean, it's possible this was the case, but I'm not aware of any large cash withdrawals. So I suppose, yes, this is possible. And I think in a case like this, it would make it, what makes it more probable is that no one in the U.S. was looking for Stephen. So he could completely fly under the radar. And it's not like anybody, if he stayed in Arizona or if he went somewhere else, it's not like anyone would know he's a missing person, because this case hardly made news in the place he disappeared from. I mean, I hope that's the case. That would be great if Stephen were still out there somewhere. But in this one, we have very little information to point anywhere. I've even wondered about this story of him going to get the hair loss medication. I question how definitive that information was, that Stephen was headed to the U.S. to get medication to treat hair loss. Did he specifically say, "I'm leaving to get this medication"? Or was that assumed because of statements he may have made in the past? If it's the former, and that is what he told his family, was that true? Was he truly going to get this medication? Or was that an excuse and he was actually doing something else? We'll probably never know. Stephen is described as a white male with brown hair and brown eyes. At the time of his disappearance, he weighed about 150 pounds and he was 5'10". He'd be 47 years old today. If you have information related to the disappearance of Stephen Milan, please contact the Coconino Sheriff's Office at 928-774-4523. That is all for this case. So let's move on to the next and final case of this episode. Harold William Roland, who went by Bill, was 50 years old at the time of his disappearance in 1997. Bill and his wife of 10 years lived in Lufkin, Texas, a city in the eastern part of the state with a population of about 33,000 in 1997. Bill was the vice president of J.O. Cheatham Contractors, a company that specialized in steel construction for warehouses and other commercial structures. Now, I don't believe Bill had children of his own, but he was a stepfather to his wife's daughter, Sherry. And while little has been shared about who Bill was, I learned a few details about him through the nature of this case. And you'll understand what I mean by that in a moment. Bill and his wife owned a home in Lufkin, but they also had a home on Lake Sam Rayburn in Broadus, Texas, about an hour from Lufkin. Bill and his wife spent Saturday, July 19th, 1997, with Sherry, his stepdaughter, celebrating Sherry's daughter's birthday. Later that day, in the evening, Bill and his wife went to their lake house where they spent time with a few friends. While they were there, a stray dog approached the lake house, and it sounded like the dog kind of hung around for a while. Bill and his wife then spent the following day, Sunday, at the lake house, but they returned to Lufkin late that night. On Monday, the next day, Bill decided he would return to the lake house to care for the stray dog. And this is what I meant by, we don't know a lot about Bill, but this tells us something. We can deduce that he had a big heart, possibly a soft spot for dogs or animals in general, to really go out of his way to drive an hour back to the lake house for the stray dog. It was a nice thing for him to do. It's also reported that Bill told a witness he was going fishing, so he had two objectives that day. Bill left his Lufkin home midday on Monday and went straight to a vet clinic where he purchased flea and tick medication, as well as some dog food. From there, he stopped at a rural grocery store only a couple of miles from his lake house where he bought a bag of ice. After that point, no one reported interacting with Bill. Bill had a cell phone and he kept in close contact with his wife. Sherry said he was always calling his wife, her mom, telling her what he was doing, where he was going. So when he didn't communicate for much of that day, it was strange. Bill did not return home to Lufkin on Monday, and I don't have his wife's account of how she felt, but if it's like the other cases we've covered, she likely tried to rationalize the situation that night. But by the next morning, she was concerned enough to report his absence to law enforcement. Because Bill resided in Lufkin, which is in Angelina County Sheriff's Office was called in, and the lake house was in San Augustine County, so that sheriff's office also became involved. Investigators visited Bill's lake house located in the Eagles View neighborhood near Powell Park. I was unable to get a street view of anywhere in this area, really, but you can tell from the aerial view that it's heavily wooded and there are these clusters of homes or neighborhoods. But overall, it's a rural area and likely not the type of place you'd find yourself accidentally. When Bill left his home in Lufkin, he was driving his 1996 extended cab Chevy pickup with a pontoon boat and trailer attached. But when the investigators arrived at the lake house, they found no sign of Bill, and his pickup, pontoon boat, and trailer were all missing. They questioned if Bill ever even made it to the lake house after his stop at the grocery store, but when they went inside, it became clear he did. They found clean clothes in the dryer, an uneaten bowl of dog food he'd prepared, and a half-eaten hamburger in the refrigerator. Unless he just wasn't very hungry, the investigators thought Bill was likely interrupted. And we don't tell personal stories much, but this scenario with the hamburger reminded me of a time where I'd prepared a bagel, toasted it, put cream cheese on it, and I was in the middle of eating it when I had the sudden realization that I thought I was going to be late to the end of Sean's race, your race you were competing in, the half Ironman. I thought I was about to miss the end of it. And my one job was to be there at the end of it. So I hastily, you know, put the bagel on a plate, threw it in the fridge and left. This was a few years ago, but I think this story is so memorable because you thought it was gross that I did that. But yeah, I just threw it away. Yeah, I think I knew I wouldn't eat it later, but it felt wasteful to just throw it away.
Yeah, when you told me that, I was just cracking up because I was just picturing a toasted bagel with cream cheese just sitting in the fridge, getting nasty. You know, it wouldn't have been that good to eat later.
No, it wouldn't. And at least in this case, a hamburger, I feel like it's a little bit different, not as gross to eat that later. But anyway, I bring this up because in that situation, I left in a rush. I was kind of interrupted by my own realization, but I left willingly. So I wondered if Bill left of his own volition, but he left in a hurry. His missing truck, boat and trailer seems to indicate that he left in his own vehicle. Plus, forcibly removing Bill would not be an easy task, considering he was between 6'1 and 6'2 and about 250 pounds. And there were no obvious signs of a struggle on or around the property.
Yeah, and it sounded like he didn't even have enough time to feed the dog because he had the dog bowl with food prepped for, you know, feeding the dog, and he just seemed like he didn't get around to bringing it outside for him.
Yeah. Yeah. His family pointed that out too, how he just left that dog bowl full of food. They really didn't think he would go to the trouble of preparing the dog food and not giving it to the dog. So, did Bill get a phone call that made him leave? Did someone come to his front door and get him to come out? There's no mention of mysterious phone calls from that day, but there are a few possibilities here. And his family believed that someone could have come to the lake house seeking help. And because Bill was so friendly and always willing to help someone in need, he would leave to assist someone. The stray dog was on the property when law enforcement arrived. He was outside and his behavior was described as strange. The dog was walking around howling, and when a car would drive up, the barking would intensify. But I don't know how much stock to put in this because we don't have a baseline for this dog. We don't know how he normally behaved. Some dogs are very vocal, so we don't know if his behavior was a sign of anything, but the way it was reported was as though it was a sign.
So they only knew about this dog for a couple of days, right?
Right.
Okay. Yeah, I was just thinking if they've seen this dog in the past and he had a pattern of behavior, this howling and this intensified barking was outside that typical behavior, then yeah, that'd definitely be a sign. But if they've only known this dog for a couple of days, then you don't really know, you know, what his typical behavior is.
Well, now that I say that, it was reported as though they'd just met this dog shortly before Bill disappeared. But I suppose maybe it was a stray dog that came up to their house, their lake house, periodically. So maybe they did have some kind of sense of its behavior. Early on, the authorities said they did not suspect foul play was involved in Bill's disappearance. However, his family disagreed. They thought there was essentially zero chance he could have gotten lost. He was a skilled outdoorsman, and he knew the area he vanished from like the back of his hand. They also had no reason to believe that he would have taken off. So they were worried from the outset that something went terribly wrong. And by Tuesday afternoon, authorities organized a massive search for Bill and his missing belongings. Angelina County Sheriff's deputies and San Augustine County Sheriff's deputies joined forces in a foot search of the area around Bill's lake house.
So they did a land search around the lake. Did they also search the lake itself?
Yes, they brought in divers to search the lake near Bill's lake house, and they were looking for both Bill and his truck, boat, and trailer. Texas Department of Public Safety troopers and Texas Rangers searched the wooded area with helicopters equipped with heat-seeking devices. Family, friends, and employees from Bell's company participated in the searches using ATVs and horses to cover more ground on the fifth day of searching, Saturday, July 26, which marked Bell's 51st birthday. I can imagine that was such an upsetting way to spend that day. They went from probably planning a birthday celebration to searching for him. Nothing of note was found during the searches, and various tips came in from the public. There was a potential sighting of Bill and his truck in Louisiana, but nothing came from that. About a week after Bill disappeared, two teenagers were riding four-wheelers on a hunting lease in the southern part of Angelina County, about 45 miles or 72 kilometers from Bill's lake house, when they came upon an abandoned Chevy pickup truck. The truck was a mile and a half, or about a mile and a half, off the main road, and they noted the truck, but did nothing about it until they came upon it again about a week later. So 2 weeks after Bill disappeared, and noticed it had been burned. They claimed that when they were there the week before, they didn't see signs of a fire. When sheriff's deputies arrived, they realized they had searched the area by air in the early days of the searches, but saw nothing. It seems like it would be easier to overlook a body than a whole truck, but this goes to show how heavily wooded that area was that the truck could go unnoticed, or the truck may have been placed there after they searched, but it was a pretty tight window. According to Fox 51, there was a burned rifle under the back seats of the truck, and an ice chest was in the bed of the truck. The person who abandoned and torched Bill's truck removed the license plates before setting it on fire. So as hard as they tried to make this an unidentifiable vehicle, they were unsuccessful. Additionally, Bill's family noticed some items he normally kept in his truck were nowhere to be found. His cell phone was missing, although that may have been destroyed in the fire. But the largest item that was missing was a fiberglass ladder that Bill had in the bed of the truck when he went to the lake house on Monday. And keep that ladder in mind, because I want to come back to it when we discuss the theories on what might have happened to Bill. Two factors about this truck stuck out to me right away. Someone had to drive that truck deep into the woods, park it, and set it on fire. So they had to have help from someone in another vehicle to get them out of the area. This is not an area where you could just walk back to where you came from or take public transportation. There certainly had to be two people involved, unless that person lived very close to this location. Also, I'd suspect this person had some familiarity with where they abandoned the truck, although that's not guaranteed. It was someone's hunting land. I suppose someone could have been familiar with the main roads out there, and they just picked a random road to drive down into the woods and dispose of the truck. There were some tools missing from Bill's truck, but when the authorities returned to the scene of the fire just a few days after the initial discovery, they found the tools. These tools were undamaged, so clearly they hadn't been in the fire, and law enforcement believed they were placed there after they had already searched the area, since their search was thorough. They didn't believe they could have just missed these tools, but I question what the point of placing the tools there would be. Like, why would you place the tools there after the fact? In August 1997, the month after Bill disappeared, his boat trailer was finally recovered. It was abandoned in Angelina National Forest, about 20 miles from Bill's lake house. Nobody knows if the boat trailer sat there the entire time Bill was missing, or if someone placed it there later. Then, in October, 3 months after Bill's vanishing, his pontoon boat was found on Lake Sam Rayburn, tucked into a cove under willow trees about 10 miles from Bill's lake house. With that location, it was clear that the person or people who left it there wanted it to be well hidden. The boat was tied off, and the pontoons on the boat had been shot with a 12-gauge shotgun, likely in an attempt to sink the boat. But the pontoons were filled with foam, and although a lot of water entered where the damage was, the boat didn't even get close to sinking.
Seems like a pretty easy way to draw a lot of attention to sink a boat, like just blasting it with a shotgun. They're, you know, if their whole goal was to sink the boat, I'm sure they could have come up with something, you know, a little more effective and discreet than just shooting it with a shotgun.
Yeah, this location, this little cove, the boat sat there for 3 months and no one noticed it. So there weren't many properties around there. Possibly people wouldn't have thought much of someone firing a shotgun. I'm not sure. But it seemed like someone was in possession of Bill's belongings, his truck, his boat trailer, and was attempting to no longer be connected to those belongings. But I kind of wondered, why not just return them to his home and just leave it there unless they thought there would be physical evidence left behind?
Yeah, and that would be, I'd imagine that'd be pretty risky to try to do.
To leave it back at his house?
Yeah, to be seen driving the pontoon boat back or driving his truck back and dropping it off.
But they had to drive it to dispose of it.
Yeah, but they're not driving back to his house.
Yeah, there would definitely be a risk there. And on the boat, there was no evidence that it was a crime scene. There was no blood or anything of that nature. Like I said, there aren't many properties along the lake in that area. So it's conceivable that someone could have left the pontoon boat there without being seen. But this also would have required help by either someone else who was in a boat that could take the person back who drove Bill's boat, and they could have fired the shotgun from another boat, or someone in a vehicle, because the person, I guess, could have driven the boat there, got out, fired the shots, then walked to the nearest road where they were picked up. Now, the boat's awning was missing when the boat was recovered. Divers actually found it in the lake not far from the boat several months later in January 1998. So that was kind of the last item of Bill's that was missing that was finally recovered. Throughout all of these discoveries and additional searches of the lake, Bill was never found. It seemed that Bill didn't have any enemies, and not many theories popped up in this case that could explain Bill's disappearance. Foul play seems probable, considering the circumstances, and I did come across one theory. In 2006, a retired Texas Ranger who worked on Bill's case, Don Morris, was interviewed for the Texas Ranger Hall of Fame and Museum. At one point during the interview, Bill's case came up when the interviewer, Tony Hill, asked Don what the most frustrating case he worked on was. Don brought up Bill's case, and he shared some interesting information. Don indicated that there was another man who had a lake house in the same cul-de-sac as Bill, who was a bit of a strange duck, as he put it. The neighbor and Bill had quite a few issues or squabbles in the year preceding Bill's disappearance. Don posed his theory that the neighbor caught Bill off guard and killed him. He didn't explain exactly how he thought the murder played out, but he described his theory on the aftermath and the disposal of Bill's body. His theory is that the person who killed Bill attached him to the ladder that was in Bill's truck that was never found. And he goes into this, frankly, confusing explanation as to why he thinks this, but I presumed he believes because the ladder was never found, it could weigh Bill down and prevent his body from rising to the surface in the lake, depending on how heavy the ladder was. And I think that's part of it. But he said, quote, "And what we was looking for, there's a ladder missing that Bill would have been attached to, because when his boat was found, Lake Rayburn does not have any boat ramps or anything like that. So people pull their boats, pontoon boats, up on the bank there to prevent them from washing back out. Well, when you do that, it's going to make the front of the pontoon boat pretty high, and the seats on the front of that pontoon, there's two seats sitting on the front of that pontoon boat. But when we found the boat, they were moved back out of the way, made room for something up there. Well, Bill had a 16-foot ladder, fiberglass ladder, in his pickup when he came over there that morning. It was never found. And if you attach Bill to that fiberglass ladder, either by rope or plastic or whatever, however you want to attach him to it, and pick up one end and put him up there and slide him like that, one man could do it. Because Bill was 250 pounds, but he wouldn't be able to lift that dead weight up that high to put him up. But if you attach him to that ladder, you could. And then he dumped him out there in the lake, and we'll never find him, but he's still there, out there in the lake somewhere, end quote. So maybe I'm the only one who found that a little confusing, but I get the gist of what he's saying. Someone would have struggled to lift Bill's body on their own, especially if the pontoon boat was angled upwards. So I think that's where the idea of the ladder comes into play here.
So he's saying the neighbor would have dumped his body towards the edge of the lake?
Yeah, that's what it sounds like from that theory. Yeah. Which I see why you're questioning that, because it seems like you'd want to go out in the middle of the lake.
Try to get to, you know, one of the deepest points, as opposed to right around the edge where it's obviously going to get a lot more shallow.
Exactly. But I suppose if you go out in a deeper part of the lake, then you're out on this boat with a deceased person there. So you run the risk of someone stopping, you know, and saying something to you in their boat and possibly seeing something that happened. So I don't know. Yeah. I can kind of see.
I'm sure he didn't do this in broad daylight. Probably did it later in the evening or something, right? To be less noticeable.
I would imagine.
If this is what happened.
Yeah, I would imagine. I still think it's possible someone else helped whoever was involved, whether it was the neighbor or another person, just because of all the disposal of everything and the pontoons being shot down and Bill's size. I understand what he's saying about attaching him to the ladder. So I suppose that could have made it easier for one person to do this.
I think there'd have to be more than one person involved, especially with the disposal of the truck and just out in the middle.
That I pointed to, yeah.
Just out in the middle of nowhere, you're likely not going to drop it off and walk back to wherever you're going.
Exactly. Right? Yeah. Yeah. So he went on to say that he believes Bill is still in the lake and that he'll never be found if he's at the bottom of the lake, even with sonar technology, which has been used in this case, because of the composition of the water. It sounds like it's pretty murky, not a lot of clarity. Even if they found Bill, it wouldn't tie his death to his neighbor. The last notable comment he made was that Bill was a tough guy who wasn't known to back down from anything, so he would have put up a fight. Which also makes you wonder how this person got the upper hand with Bill, and if the neighbor did do something to him, how did he get him to come out of his house? Did he just start something with Bill and Bill went outside to handle it? Because it didn't really sound, I mean, it sounded like they didn't like each other. So I don't really see Bill going out just to chat with this neighbor. But the idea that the person responsible for Bill's disappearance and presumed death lived near him makes sense because, like I said earlier, where his lake house was, it was a secluded area. I didn't see any information related to where this neighbor was when Bill disappeared or if he had an alibi. This is the only plausible theory I came upon, but there could be people who have heard rumors about what happened, especially if more than one person was involved. We don't know if that's the case, but it seems probable. There were likely people who saw something of value back in 1997 with the disposal of Bill's truck, boat, and boat trailer. It's likely someone saw a different person driving Bill's truck, but they couldn't have known what they saw would become significant. Bill's described as a white male with gray and blonde hair. When he disappeared, he was about 6'1 to 6'2 and weighed 250 pounds. He'd be 78 years old today. If you have information related to the disappearance of Bill Roland, please contact Crime Stoppers at 1-800-252-8477, and you can stay anonymous. Or you can submit information through the Texas Ranger Cold Case website or by contacting the Texas Department of Public Safety Missing Persons Hotline at 1-800-346-3243. Thank you all so much for listening today. That is all for now, but we will be back next week with a new case. Bye.
Bye.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen, brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
Do you love true crime podcasts and true crime documentaries?
If so, you gotta check out our podcast, True Crime Obsessed, where we recap the true crime documentaries everybody's watching.
We say everything you're thinking and probably screaming at your TV.
We've been at the top of the podcast charts for almost 9 years, and we have over 400 episodes for you to check out right now.
We cover the cases everyone's talking about, and we also highlight the cases that have been underreported, overlooked, or forgotten.
With over 30,000 five-star reviews on Apple Podcasts, if you've never checked out True Crime Obsessed, now's the time to give us a try.
Find True Crime Obsessed wherever you get your podcasts.